It took me a couple of years to understand this, but I'm confident that I've got it correct. What we've seen with Russia, one of the criticisms that emerges out of the West is, oh, look how slow the Russians are moving. They've only been able to take this limited amount of territory, et cetera. And yet, when we look at the actual number of Russian forces, they've been building up slowly. They've not been in a panic. And what I mean by a panic, they haven't declared a national emergency at which they've mobilized, because they've got the potential to upward of 15 million men that they could mobilize immediately, reservists. They haven't done that. They've been doing, they had that one mobilization, then they've been relying upon both recruitment conscripts as well as contract soldiers. And when they bring them in, there's a gap, a 3 to 6 month gap between the time they show up, put on a uniform, and then that they're actually considered trained that they can move forward to the front lines. What we've seen in 2025 is finally Russia had reached a level of strength on the front lines that right now they are conducting 9 separate offensive operations all along that 1,300 kilometer line of contact. Significant. They've never done that before. They didn't do it in 2023, 2024. In each of those years, they were limited to the one, possibly two offensive operations. But now they've got the strength, the troop strength to do it. NATO still, after, you know, we're coming upon the fourth year of this, has still been unable to solve the problem of producing sufficient weapons and, you know, go down the category: drones, artillery shells, tanks, artillery barrels, air defense systems, Patriots. In no area does NATO have superiority or dominance over Russia. Not a single one. Now, they talk a good game. Yeah, we're going to do 5%. You know, reminds me of Wimpy from the Popeye commercial. I'll gladly pay you Tuesday for a hamburger
Murder
today.
today.
Yeah. They're, hey, yeah, well, we'll get that 5% to you. Just trust us. And we're supposed to trust them. Well, there's not a single economy in NATO, in the European version, that's growing above 1.5%. Not a single one. And several of them are actually in demonstrated recession. UK, Germany, France in particular are in recession. They're not growing. And the German factories are fleeing Germany because of rising energy costs that they self-inflicted. Oh, yeah, we'll destroy the Russian source. And then Western sanctions are leading countries like Bulgaria to say, and Hungary say, you're killing us here. You're going to make energy costs impossible. And so you're going to cripple our economies. So instead of seeing NATO come together, you know, Mark Rutte, oh, yeah, boy, we're all together, it's fragmenting and it's coming apart at the seams because there is no consensus. And Russia right now, with the offense that's underway, I mean, it's now advancing. It did 42 square kilometers yesterday in Zaporizhia alone.
Oh, wow. In one
And
day, I didn't see that.
So it's moving. It's doing it from the north, it's doing it from the south, and it's doing it from the east, moving west. And Ukraine doesn't have an answer because Ukraine doesn't have the manpower. They have been decimated over the course of the last 3.5 years. They're suffering basically 40,000 casualties per month. And they've been doing that every month of this year. Well, you know, here we are in month 11, so we're over 500,000. You know, so let's see, 440,000 casualties just this year alone. Almost, you know, 500,000 men. They don't have the manpower. They don't have these large reserves, and they certainly don't have the luxury of being able to recruit people and put them through a training program that at the end of 6 months or 9 months, they come out somewhat competent and able to conduct combat operations. No, man, they throw a uniform on them, give them a gun, and say, get out there to the front. Good luck.
Yeah, well, that seems to corroborate your assessment there of the Ukrainian losses. And of course, that doesn't even count any of the desertions that just add on to the loss of the manpower. Meanwhile, on the Russian side, they still have not had a need to go to a forced mobilization other than that first one of 300,000 several years ago. The motivations continue to be there for people to come in. The bonuses and all that stuff, a lot of them are high. Fair enough. But it works, and they get them in right there. The bottom line is they continue to calculate that it's worth it to come in and take that risk for the benefit, because they think it's more benefit than there is loss. So that's just on the surface of it. But that seems to corroborate when you look at this in the bigger picture, especially when you're talking about the air war and the advancements in the Russian glide bombs, the advancements in their drone warfare, especially in the strategic versions, the Garand 3s, et cetera, their missile factory, all that stuff together. There are more and more people that are saying, I think that this could come to a culmination sometime, maybe even at the end of the winter, first of the spring. It's hard to see how they continue to make up. I mean, with those numbers, Larry, I mean, at some point, math has to affect, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. In fact, it was just yesterday, day before yesterday, the Russians unveiled a new military service. So they have set up a specific branch that deals exclusively with drone warfare. And the purpose of this makes sense. Is to integrate it fully into the other branches of service, so that it's fully integrated with both the operations of ground forces and the operations of the Air Force. But because it's sort of a unique level of skill that you've got they're using a combination of, they've now got AI-driven drones that do both reconnaissance and attack. So they are not dependent upon an operator. They no longer have an operator there giving them signals. They're able to operate independently. They've got that. They've got the FPV drones, but that are driven with fiber optics, so they are immune to electronic warfare interference. So,
yeah, I've also heard in recent days, I don't know if you've heard anything on this, that as a subset of that branch, they also have a department whose sole job it is to go find and then destroy the Ukrainian operators, not even the drones but the operators. Yeah. Can you tell us anything about that?
Oh, yeah. In fact, that's what that has been, decided shift over the last 3 or 4 months, which is they recognize that these frontline troops that are sitting in trenches, they really don't represent much of a threat. You know, they're just there taking up space. They're going after the drones. I mean, the rapid development of the drone warfare on both sides, Russia. You know, in 2023, you could make a case that Ukraine, with the assistance of NATO, had a decided advantage over Russia. But, you know, the Russians were quick learners. And what they demonstrated was the troops in the field were communicating back up the chain of command. Chain of command was in communication with industry, and industry responded very rapidly. They were not constrained with the kinds of acquisition,
bureaucracy and whatever.
Boondoggles we get here in the West. So now Russia has not only caught up, they're now surpassed anything that that both Ukraine and or the West can do. So, you know, they've now, like I said, there's not a single area of weapons development or technology in which the West has an advantage, not one.
And you say the West, not even just Ukraine.
Yeah, exactly. Not just Ukraine, NATO. I mean, you know, NATO hasn't deployed a single operational hypersonic missile, for example. Russia's got at least 4 variants, or 5, depending on how you count it. And so, you know, we don't have that. And then when you've got this recent, you know, with the Berezhnik, as well as the Poseidon missiles that were recently released. And again, I think your conversation with Ted Postol the other day was very insightful. It gives people a great understanding of, what some of those capabilities are. So the United States is lagging behind, and it's not like our economy is doing great. And so this we're good at talking, but we're not really good at doing.
Yeah, and that leads to, I mean, I think that we're nearing the point to where just the cumulative weight of all of these things is going to possibly sink the Ukraine side. And maybe by the springtime or the end of the winter, the Ukraine side just is not able to continue waging war anymore. What's that going to do to the West?
So let's look at what would we expect to see if Ukraine, let's say, had a viable chance of surviving. Okay, you'd see that their recruitment numbers were at around 50 to 60,000 a month. So they would both be able to replace the numbers that had been lost as casualties, as well as adding another 20,000 on top of that. Well, we're not seeing that. And if we were seeing that they were taking recruits and putting them through basic training or advanced individual training, I mean, you know you're from your days in service that just because you put a uniform on somebody doesn't need to know that they know how to march or know the right from their left. So you got to start with those basics. And
let me just kind of add in a little interject here. Especially during my time when we fought in Desert Storm under Doug McGregor, I observed firsthand, first in the unit that I was in, how profoundly it matters how you're trained, even on top of who's in uniform. There was an organization, I was in a company size element. It was called Eagle Troop of 2nd Squadron, 2nd Cavalry. And we were not very good. When I first got there as a second lieutenant, the morale was really low. There was a very weak company commander that was in charge of it. And we did not perform well at all when we went to the National Training Center, the CMTC, they called it, the European version of the National Training Center, when we did these force-on-force things. We get one guy, and his name was H.R. McMaster at the company level.
Yeah.
Now, I've had some problems with how he was when he was National Security Advisor and what happened in Afghanistan. But as a company commander, he was spectacular under fire, and he just radically changed the tune. So when he came in at the same time McGregor came in as the what they call the S3 operations officer, who was in charge of training the entire organization, it just turned it upside down and we just became this lethal killing machine. But I saw other squadrons that did not get that kind of training and didn't have that kind of leadership in the same uniforms, in the same regiment, perform very, very different in combat. So what you're saying there is far more true, I think, than some people recognize, the training aspect.
Oh, yeah, no, it's critical. And, well, and implicit in that training, as you didn't say it specifically, is leadership. If you got to have the right leadership. And unfortunately, what has happened in Ukraine is some of the best leaders have been killed or wounded and put out of action. And a large number of them have strong incentives to enrich themselves. They say, there's no way we can win this. So I'm going to salt away some money for myself. And I mean, one of the ways they do it is they don't report casualties, because if they reported casualties, they'd have to do payouts. And so they keep soldiers on the books, so the money keeps coming in for those soldiers, and they're able, for those soldiers who are dead or wounded, take the money and put it into their own bank account. I mean, that has been happening.
Do other soldiers in the unit, are they aware that this is going on, or is this behind the scenes?
Absolutely.
And I mean, wouldn't do a lot for morale.
Yeah, morale. No, listen, morale is, it's terrible throughout the Ukrainian army. But there's still some who are, they're fighting bravely. They believe in the cause for what it is. But, until we start seeing those signs that they're able to recruit 60,000 a month, they're able to train them for a 3 to 6 month time period, and then they're able to be put into units that are properly led. But that's not happening.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, so we got to step back and say, okay, that's not happening. Whereas it is happening on the Russian side. I mean, one of the advantages, Russia's got the ability to reach in and touch any military base in Western Ukraine. Ukraine does not have the ability to target any military base whatsoever in Russia. And so Russia certainly can put its troops, they're past they're east of the Ural Mountains. They're quite safe there. They can conduct training without fear of being attacked. And it's just a reality. Then we in the West refuse to acknowledge or accept that. And then, but I think the more important aspect here is one of leadership. And there is, there's not a lot of confidence in the chain of command.
No, there's not. And that's pretty obvious when you look really from every level all the way on down. In the last segment, I want to talk about here something that could be even more important for the United States, and that's at the strategic level, and I'm specifically talking about the potential for nuclear escalation and conflict, which has always been kind of in the background, sometimes more so than others, something that's always worried about, that I've always worried about. The longer the war goes on, the longer we keep alive the possibility of somebody making a dumb decision, an accident, a miscalculation, something, and things move in a bad direction. That has taken renewed focus here of late because you mentioned a minute ago the Poseidon and the Burevestnik missile, both nuclear propulsion, one underwater, one up in the air, cruise missile, et cetera. So Vladimir Putin launched those and did a test and made a big kind of ballyhoo about, you know, we've now have this new capability as a deterrence against the West to say, don't mess with this because we have these new additional capabilities on top of what we already knew. So it didn't really change a whole lot, but just reinforced, no, really, we have a lot of capabilities. Don't test us here. Well, that wasn't the message that was received in the White House, apparently, because President Trump said, oh, yeah, you can test nuclear weapons. So can I. And he said, we're going to do nuclear tests. That's not what Russia did. And when tried to clarify that, what the United States meant, Trump never clarified it because people say, wait, are you talking? Because he said a nuclear weapons test, not a platform test. And so they tried to get some clarification. He said, no, I'm going to do that. Well, the Russians apparently also asked for some clarification. They didn't get it either. However, on the 4th of November, at the U.S. Senate, there was a hearing for a fellow named Robert Kudlak, if I'm going to get that name correct here. Let me show you something that happened here in a hearing, because this was definitely noticed in Russia, and there was this very specific response from Sergei Lavrov. But let me show you. This is a conversation here and an answer or a question by Senator, former not naval. Well, I guess he was a naval aviator. He was also
astronaut.
That's what the word I was trying to get out of my head. Here's what, listen to this question that he asked and watch the answer about nuclear weapons testing.
There is no benefit, or maybe if you think there is there anything to be said about destabilization?
And by the way, I'm sorry, he's being interviewed, or not interviewed here, but his hearing is to be the Assistant Secretary of Defense for nuclear deterrence and weapons testing. So that is his role.
By doing this.
Senator, I appreciate the question. And I would just offer that at this stage in an earlier questioning, there was a question about what was meant by the opportunity or issue of testing at this moment. I would just highlight more from a background or context perspective. There seems to be three reasons why you would want to test. One are technical uncertainties about the weapon. And clearly, I think in the context of what has happened recently with the president receiving the report that certifies our stockpile is both safe, secure, and effective and reliable, that doesn't seem to be the issue. The second one seems to be broadly whether or not there is an issue around the qualifications or capabilities of the nuclear enterprise in terms of how that would be affected by resuming testing. And clearly, we're making huge investments to recapitalize and modernize our enterprise, both the human capital as well as the physical capital. So that doesn't seem to be the issue. The third one seems to be whether there's geopolitical context or reasons to do that. Earlier I mentioned, not based on the president's comments, but based on a review of compliance reports by State Department going back to 2019, that would suggest that there's been a concern about both Russia and China's adherence or compliance with the threshold test ban treaty and whether or not there's been any issues around that. Obviously, that's a classified set of issues. It was identified such in the State Department, in the State Department reports, and that's something that have not been briefed on.
Okay, so bottom line is here, he says there are several reasons why you might want to do a test. One is the reliability of the weapon system. He said that's not an issue. We definitely are reliable there. Another one might be, is there any other operational constraints? He said there's not really there either. But the issue of the strategic environment, maybe there could be something there, but that's beyond my pay grade. I'm not going to worry about that. That was heard in Moscow. Here is how Sergei Lavrov responded to that, I think yesterday.
Kadlec, who is running for the position of Assistant Secretary of Defense, stated that it is necessary to develop nuclear response options for certain potential regional conflicts. This is also an interesting statement. It is already a direct indication that this gentleman, in his future position as Assistant Secretary of Defense, will be thinking in the spirit of threats to use nuclear weapons in order to achieve solutions desired by the United States in one region or another.
And Gary, I'm sorry, that I should have played the other one first. If you can play the other one by Sergey Lavrov on that same topic, that would be even better.
Mr. Robert Kadlec has been nominated for the position of Assistant Secretary of Defense, as the head of the Pentagon is now called. He spoke in Congress a few days ago, last week, I believe. He was interrogated on the topic of nuclear testing and the current administration's approach to nuclear weapons. He said that Trump's decisions to resume nuclear testing were dictated by geopolitical considerations. There is still no technical necessity for them. This is a strong statement. I do not know to what extent the author himself, whom I have just quoted, realizes the seriousness of what he said. But we must perceive this in the sense that, as we have stated, there is no technical necessity for such tests. Then he himself, in a way, completed this thought for us by saying that the purpose, it turns out, is geopolitical. What could be a geopolitical goal for the United States? Dominance. If the factor of nuclear weapons is being used for this purpose, that is alarming.
So as a real background, President Putin himself just a week or so ago said that we will continue to abide by the nuclear nonproliferation treaty, the NPT treaty, unless the United States tests first, and then we're going to test as well. But now here you have this Assistant Secretary of Defense nominee suggesting that maybe we will. What do you make of it?
Well, again, you got to look at it as the Russians perceive it. Number one, George W. Bush canceled the anti-ballistic missile treaty agreement, walked away from arms control. The U.S. administrations, both Republican and Democrat, now under Trump, have always used the excuse that, oh, China and Russia are violating the terms of the agreement. Oh, they're breaking with what they signed on to. With really no evidence of that. But then, again, who was it that suspended the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Agreement? That was Donald Trump. And most, the latest is the request by Russia to the United States, are we going to continue to abide by the New START Treaty? And again, silence, crickets coming out of Washington, D.C., no agreement. So, obviously both the Russians and the Chinese have to, based upon these statements, have to assume the United States is preparing for nuclear war, and therefore they have no other alternative but to make similar preparations. That is the last thing in the world they want to do. But we're in, for those in your audience who are under the age of 50, encourage them to go look up the movie Dr. Strangelove, Stanley Kubrick's movie. You need to watch that because we're back into that kind of era, and it's the United States is hurtling towards a very dangerous territory. It reminded me. So back in 1981, so this was still during the height of the Cold War, I was teaching at American University in the Washington Semester Program. And part of I had 3 days a week I'd have to fill with speakers. So I took my students down to the then Soviet embassy. And at this time, one of the issues that was, sort of a hot button issue between the Soviets and the United States was the deployment of the Pershing 2 missiles into Europe. This intermediate range ballistic missile that was seen there as to counter what the Soviets were doing. It wasn't clear the Soviets had the same capability at that time. And when we got in and started talking to, I assume it was a political counselor, the Soviets then were very defensive and quite insecure. And so when we brought up the fact, the United States has the Pershing 2 missile, the reaction was like, well, we got that too. Yeah, we got that too. And that's the first, when Trump started speaking, man, that was the first thing I thought about. It's because he's speaking from a position of weakness, not of strength. Because as you know, When you've got the strength on your side, when you've got, you're solid about what you're doing, you don't need to talk. You just sort of nod your head and say, oh, that's interesting. Because you know what you can do. and you know that you got the other side beat. The Russians are being very clear right now that they are extremely concerned with the comments. It's not just what Trump is saying. It's comments coming out from other officials in the Trump administration. And they can only assume that the United States is intent upon using nuclear weapons. And therefore, they have to take appropriate measures to defend themselves.
And according to what Sergey Lavrov has said, and the defense minister, Belousov, I believe his name is, opened a test, or they're in the process of actually taking out of mothballs an actual nuclear testing facility. So in the event that an order is given, they're gonna make effective it. I don't think that they're bluffing. I think that they're probably telling the truth. The question is, do you think that that message, because I can imagine, and you tell me if I'm interpreting wrong, I think the only reason they would do that to actually make good on that, to bring the thing out of mothballs, is as a deterrent to tell us don't do it, especially in combination with Putin's claim that we won't do it unless you do, and then I think we will. Will the message be received?
Well, yeah, and I would say no, it won't be received. Because when the Russians do that, then we'll use that as justification. See, they're intent on attacking us, so we got to do. So we use it as end up talking past each other, and it's that famous line from one of the Paul Newman movies. What we have here is a failure to communicate, and the communication is key. But as we saw the other day that Scott Bessent, the Secretary of Treasury, called Kirill Dmitriev, who is Putin's basic envoy for talking to the United States about opening up lines of communication, Bessent called him a liar. Called him a liar because simply Dmitriev disagrees with Bessent's belief. Bessent believes that through economic pressure we can weaken Russia. And Dmitriev says, no, you can't. You think those sanctions are going to have the effect, they're not. And instead of, dealing with that as a disagreement between people where you can at least have some mutual respect, Bessent devolved into this insult. And it's just, okay, that doesn't help. That doesn't help the communication. We're getting pushed towards a nuclear threshold that is very, very dangerous.
Yeah, and that's like I keep saying every time, and we'll continue to. That's not bad for the United States. It's not bad for Russia. It's bad for the planet. And nobody would win in such a situation, and I pray to God that we don't lose our minds and go down a path that can't succeed, and it can only destroy our own way of life is what it is. And we'll have to wait and see, but there it is. That's where we have it.
Well, it's important what you're doing. When you bring on people like Ted Postol and people like Doug McGregor and myself, where we get a chance to try to say, hey, look, there is an alternative here. And it's a pathway built around dialogue and talking to one another. We don't need to fight and kill ourselves.
No, we certainly don't need to do that. And, one of the reasons we love having you on, besides the fact that you always have great wardrobe choices. But other than that, you also have some great things to say. We really appreciate that. Be sure and go to sonar21.com where you don't have to wait for Larry to be on here once a week. We'd love to have it more, but you don't have to wait. You can go and see his work there. He's always got some interesting things. We always are watching it and reading some of those things. So be sure and check him out there, and we will look forward to seeing you next time that you're on the show.
Thanks so much, Danny. It's always a pleasure.
And we appreciate you guys, too. Also, we got another show for you coming up at, I believe it's 3 o'clock. No, 2 o'clock, 2 p.m. We have Matthew Ho, former State Department official. Great, great American, somebody we love to have on the show. And you're going to not want to miss what he has to say this afternoon at 2 p.m. on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive. And also, be sure and let your friends know who may like to get their information via podcast that we are on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podcast Addict. Be sure and type. And you will find us there ahead of our jingle, which Gary will now play.